Yes, it is Pet Chat, and I'm joined by Cheryl Shaw and Dr. David Tabrett. Good afternoon.
G'day, Amanda.
Hello.
Good to have you. Now, Cheryl, I noticed you've got, looks like a little house
a little
on your
house.
Pin today. What are we talking about?
Okay, we're going to be talking about selecting a pet if you live in an apartment.
Oh, that's a good topic.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. What about you, David?
Well, I was looking at our case log in our hospital, thinking about what we should be talking about. And then I found out Dr. Kimberly's talked about ticks recently, which is
how
obviously.
Dare she?
I know. But look, the other big thing at this time of year is the snakes are out and about.
Oh, David.
Oh, yes.
And we've had some very interesting patients come through, which I just wanted to highlight some of the features and what to look out for.
Yeah, that's a great idea. Mm. Yeah. Okay, wonderful. Okay. All right, yeah, we've got some good topics today. Pets in apartments, Cheryl.
Yes, I thought it was a good topic, as you said, Amanda, because a lot of people are moving into apartments now, and particularly a lot of people that are changing their lifestyle. They're, you know, moving into a place that they don't have to look after so much. But often when you move, you still want to have a pet. But making the right pet choice is really important, because you can, if you do want to have, you know, less time spending looking after animals, you then got to choose something that's just going to fit that lifestyle. Maybe some fish, David.
Maybe a snake.
Oh, no. Now, look, he said that just to rev me up, honestly. He knows how scared I am of snakes. But, you know, snakes do make, for some people, great pets.
Non-venomous.
Non-venomous, yes. Mm. And, you know, some of their enclosures are really good.
And you need a license.
And you do need a license.
Oh, really?
This is really important, because for snake people who keep snakes, they absolutely adore them. It's just me that won't visit, okay? My daughter has snakes, and I can tell you she hasn't seen me at her house for a year. So anyway, she can visit me. But when you do think about keeping a snake, there's other things that you can keep as well. You can keep rats and mice and rabbits. They do really well in apartment living, and they don't take up a lot of time. Obviously, there's a little bit of training to do with rabbits with the toileting, but they're quite easy to keep inside. One of the other things that fish are great, as long as you're not going into the marine fish, which become very costly and a lot more time consuming. But for those, they're pretty easy going. Now, birds are great in apartments. Things like canaries, which I adore, finches, some of the smaller parrots, budgerigars, things like that, and quarians. Mm. But don't go getting in your apartment a major Mitchell or a sulfur-crested cockatoo or a long-billed corella, because you are going to... galahs, yes. They are going to screech, and you're going to end up with neighbourhood problems. So it's really important to consider, if you are going to have a bird, that it's going to be a quiet bird, because, as I said, some of those can really make some horrendous noises and upset the other tenants around you. Cats are perfect for apartment living. They just really, all they want is a window that they can look out and have a view, and they'll just settle in. And actually, cats that live inside, so an apartment cat, is going to have a lot longer life. We know that. And also, so are the native animals around, because the cat won't have an opportunity to get to them. David, dogs, they are fabulous. But it's really important that we get the right breed of dog. You know, a border collie, a kelpie, any of the working breeds are a no-go. Because they need a job to do, they need a lot more space than a lot of dogs, and they are going to go stir crazy. So selecting a dog, a breed of dog that suits, you know, you, I mean, obviously you have to like the type of dog, because some people aren't big on chihuahuas, other people really like them. But chihuahuas make great little dogs in the environment of an apartment, and so do things like Bichons, standard poodles are great, greyhounds, all of those dogs that, you know, sort of just want to find a nice lounge to lay on.
Yeah. You know, one of the most popular apartment dogs in Germany is Boxers.
Boxers, yep.
Which are quite an energetic breed. So I think they may well be okay, although I'm not sure how you china and find, you know, pictures and so on sitting on the sideboard might survive. But obviously you have to also tailor the amount of exercise.
Yes.
Just because you've got a small dog in an apartment doesn't mean you're getting away from having to exercise them regularly.
Yeah, and that's it, David. When you have a dog, you need to do early training. And there's a lot of commitment to that as well, because you've got to work out their toileting, where they're going to go. A lot of apartments have communal toileting areas now, but if you're needing to go take them for walks and things, you need a really good routine when you live in an apartment. That routine is going to be important. Otherwise, the dog's not going to get enough stimulus and it's going to start barking and whining. And again, you'll have neighbourhood complaints. But, you know, selecting the right breed, a dog that isn't too high energy, like some of your Jack Russells, they can just be yappy and really high energy dogs. Some of them won't go so well in that environment. They need a lot more space to run around. So, you know, making the right choice is really important.
Okay. Good advice. Well, we've got Peter from Valentine on the line. Hi, Peter. Thank you for holding. How can we help you?
Oh, that's okay. Look, my dog is actually, she's a border collie. She's a small border collie. She's actually sprained her hock joint on like the rear leg mid joint.
Yep.
And I was just wondering if you guys had any recommendations for a suitable hock brace just to sort of support that joint while the ligaments are trying to hurl and avoid sort of overextending it again.
Have you seen a vet with this problem, Peter?
I have, yeah. And I've tried a hock brace and it was totally unsuitable. So I was just wondering if you guys had any preferred providers or suppliers or whatever to get a good fit and et cetera.
It really depends on the actual injury. So what we're talking about for everyone else is that, all of our joints and dogs have support around the joint that hold them in position but also allow movement through an arrangement of ligaments around the joints. So the knee is one where we see ligament injury a lot, just like in people, and the hock or the ankle in dogs is another joint that is also largely governed by, or its movement, I should say, is governed by the position and the movement of these ligaments. The hock joint also has some bony conformation that makes it otherwise fairly stable. But if you look at it, the dog, any dog from the side, you'll notice that they've got that kink in their leg, which means that the top of the leg wants to slide off the bottom of the leg, if you like. So the ligaments are what hold it in place. So what happens is if you have some sort of injury, do you know how this happened, Peter?
Look, I'm not entirely sure. She had jumped a fairly high fence, and yeah. I'm suspecting when she landed on the other side,
she's overextended.
Yeah. So when she puts weight on it, it just sort of collapses a bit.
Drops
you know?
Down.
Sort of holding up.
Yep.
Yeah, that's what it is.
Yeah, so it's exactly right, as Peter's saying. So some sort of injury that has torn the ligaments that are holding the joint in a particular position. And because the ligaments are all around the joint, we see different type of movement or displacement associated with whichever ligament is damaged. So, for instance, if it's one of the collateral ligaments, which are on the side, so what happens is the foot will kink out laterally or medially, depending on which side is broken. And then if there's this injury that Peter's describing where the ligament is on the back of the joint, then what happens is when they put weight down, their hock or their ankle, if you like, almost moves down to touch the ground. And it really depends on how damaged it is, which is kind of the point about getting that veterinary feedback. So some of those can be managed by surgery, and that probably gives you the best outcome. But there is also this period of time where there's rehabilitation and a brace. A lot of the time now we're starting to use braces for these dogs. So when I was a young vet, we used to use plaster of Paris and put these dogs in a cast and hope that everything went well. And plaster casts do not do well around a hock joint, let me tell you, because there's too many pressure points, there's too many areas they can rub and get damaged. Then we move to fiberglass, okay, which is a little bit better. Then we move to what's called a lateral splint. So I'm not sure if this is the one that you used, Peter, where there's just a splint on one side and it's bandaged around the leg.
It was above the hock joint, it had a wrap, and below the hock joint, it had a wrap, and it was like a metal form metal either side to just stop it from collapsing. That's basically what it was.
Yeah. And that's, as you can see, what we're doing is we're progressing in the technology and the arrangement of these splints. We're now getting to the point where you can actually get 3D printed splints for your dog. And I'm, to tell you the truth, I'm not quite sure how we might access that. It's probably worth asking your vet about a referral to a surgeon, not so much for surgery, but even just because they might even ring the specialist surgeon and say who those contacts are, because there are some in Australia, there are some overseas. And the last I checked, which was over a year ago, we had to go overseas for those 3D printed braces, but we might have them in Australia now. So, and that would probably give you the better outcome.
Yeah, I'm trying to avoid the surgery option because that's not, you know, issues down the track that I'm really, that's where I really don't want to go.
Well, it's worth a chat to ask your vet to speak to a specialist, because they would have the contacts. The other thing you could do is also ask for a referral to a rehab veterinarian, and because this is the kind of thing they deal with all the time. Whether the dog's had surgery or not, it's just like us. If you get an injury, you've got to go to see the physio, etc. You need to have a program to get back into action and to support that joint. So I do know some people who could provide a rehab program, and they also have access to some of these braces that you're talking about.
Just ask
your vet about a referral to a rehab vet, and if not, they can give me a call otherwise, and I'll be able to send them in the right direction.
That's reassuring.
All right.
No worries.
Thanks for your call, Peter. Appreciate it.
No worries.
Bye. Bye. We're going to talk about snakes, David.
Oh, I love them.
I don't.
I'm leaving the room.
Yeah. Just let me get my bag, because I brought in a show and tell. Oh. No, look, it is, I just mentioned at the top of the show, this is heading into warmer weather. We see ticks. Kimberly's talked about those. So let's talk about snakes as a creature that can harm our pets and does so quite regularly, unfortunately. And I'm also prompted by, there was a story about a black snake, red-bellied black snake, down at the foreshore at Warners Bay, hiding under one of those timber walkways. Now, for anyone who didn't all catch up on this, the snake is no longer there. Unfortunately, a snake catcher went there, wasn't able to get it, but then the next day the snake got out of the walkway and I think got struck by a car on the road, sadly. And for those who might say, well, the only good snake is a dead snake, if we didn't have those snakes around, think of the number of rats we would otherwise have running around the foreshore. True. Okay, so they do form an important part of our environmental sustainability. But just going back to what happens if one of them comes across a dog or cat, and this one of the things we know is in this region, in the Hunter, we are kind of blessed in a way by our waterways, but that also brings the snakes. So pretty much most snake bites occur within 500 metres of a waterway, including rivers, creeks, streams, things like that. So we do see in this region also the main species of snakes, venomous snakes, that our pets encounter are the red-bellied black snake and the eastern brown. And occasionally we do see tiger snake envenomation. I've seen one in about 20-something years that was up from the Wattagan Mountains. So generally, and as I said, very general, black snakes tend to be more coastal, brown snakes tend to be more drier areas up the valley, but we have seen eastern brown snakes in the local community in Newcastle. And so all of these snakes should be considered dangerous, certainly to pets, but also to humans. So don't feel like you need to, if your pet is in danger or has been bitten, there's no need to kill the snake, all right? You don't need to do that, because there is a real risk that you will be bitten. So that's my first message. Don't go trying to bring us a snake. First of all, we don't really want to see it. And secondly, we don't want you to end up in hospital as well. Interestingly, with that those species, one of the things we see is, of course, we're saying we've got dogs and cats are the most likely species to be envenomated, and they have quite different reactions to the venom. And dogs, we do tend to see the more classical symptoms come on very suddenly, where they can develop all sorts of problems, but typically vomiting, collapse, cardiovascular collapse. They can get bleeding disorders and paralysis. And that's kind of the realm of the problems we deal with. Cats can get the same symptoms, but sometimes they're less severe. Sometimes they're delayed. I've seen cats that come in, you know, a day later. Now, maybe it's because the cat got bitten and then ran away and you find it. But I have seen cats that have actually been mildly lethargic following a suspected snake bite and then turn up the next day and then they're fully paralyzed. It's really weird because the venom moves through the lymphatic vessels in our body and gets absorbed into the bloodstream that way. So it moves really quickly. We're not quite sure why it is that we're seeing this difference with cats and dogs. So I've mentioned a few of those symptoms, and this is really at the heart of it. One of the problems with treating patients with snake bite is that they can present with multitude of symptoms, and these can overlap with some of our other problems that we see in pets. So, for instance, we could see patients that are paralyzed and wonder or ask the question, is this caused by a tick? Is this caused by a snake? We need to try and investigate and find out. Obviously, the treatments are quite different. Their time in hospital is different and so on. So even the just simple fact that your pet has collapsed should be a reason for you to get to the vet anyway. But they're kind of the things at this time of year that we're going to be looking at. The other problems that I mentioned too was in regards to those symptoms. If you have a dog, and this doesn't happen with cats really, but it does happen with dogs, and they encounter a snake, they get bitten, they may vomit and collapse, and then within 5 minutes they're up and they look like they're normal, all right? And I've seen this happen a lot, and clients, pet owners, look at their pet and go, oh, he mustn't have got bitten, it's really temporary, he's fine. It's quite the opposite, okay? That dog who had that collapse and vomit and then recovers has received possibly a lethal venom dose. And that is what we call a pre-paralytic syndrome. And that dog needs to be treated urgently with anti-venom and other treatments because it's likely that they'll be completely paralyzed within an hour and need to be on a ventilator and life support. So pre-paralytic syndrome, they collapse and then next thing you know, they're up and they look fine. You still need to get them seen to as quick as you can.
David, just on that, my dog was bitten by a snake, but he didn't get paralysed at all. So it was a really interesting lead up to finding out that he was bitten by a snake because he didn't get that typical...
Yeah, the presentation.
Yes.
Cheryl's dog is quite unique. we were involved in the initial presentation in our hospital, and so it was actually quite confusing and did not present with the typical signs. And this is one of the features that we see with snakes is that we think of, say, okay, they got bitten by a black snake, they're going to have these symptoms. They got bitten by a brown snake, they're going to have these symptoms. But there's actually variability within the species about sorry, I should back up a sec. Snake venom is made up of 1,000 venoms and they are grouped into 5 main types. And there's hundreds of venoms components. Some are proteins, some are enzymes, things that react with nerve cells, things that react with blood clotting, etc. And so any individual snake could produce a venom that has quite a different reaction to the next snake. And more importantly, a different venom and a different reaction to the same snake biting your dog maybe a week later. And what we tend to see also is that we see red-bellied black snakes all up and down the East Coast, right? But the snakes up in southeast Queensland present quite differently to the snake. I keep saying the snakes present. The dogs that are bitten by those snakes up there present quite differently to the dogs bitten by the same species of snake say, in Newcastle.
How interesting is that?
Yeah. So in southeast Queensland, the predominant problem that they see is massive bleeding. So these dogs are just, blood's just pouring out of their lungs, out of their stomach, out of their throat, out of their eyes, their mouth. Oh. Down here, this is with red-bellied black snakes, down here we tend to see a lot more dogs. They'll have some of that, but they actually tend to develop more of paralysis. And we actually see a lot more coagulopathies or coagulation problems with dogs that are bitten by Eastern Browns than they see up there. So Eastern Browns almost always produce severe paralysis as well. So we've got this, if I pick up a textbook, I'll read about snakes in Australia and they produce this venom and this is what happens. But then I have to look and see, okay, well, where did the author do their research? Because if they're in Queensland, it's going to be a different scenario to, say, research done down in the Sydney Basin or even, for instance, in WA, where they have different species of snakes, similar, same genus, okay, the black snakes and the brown snakes. But they have the Western Brown, we have the Eastern Brown, same families of snakes, but completely different symptoms. So it really depends on, where they're coming from. And what happens is we're recording all this data and we're putting it into a big database across Australia where we can actually get a much better picture of, these regional differences, how we treat our patients, how they respond, what's the likelihood of response and survival. And without diving into the treatment, that's a whole nother hour. But if we can get antivenom into these pets quickly and life support treatment with intravenous fluids and oxygen therapy, sometimes we need to give them blood transfusions, then we have a pretty good chance, I'm saying kind of 85, 90% chance of survival with almost all snake species that we see in our local area, if we can get that antivenom in early. And hopefully, though, we want to avoid them. Yeah. So don't let your pet run out into the bush. Just be careful around waterways. I mean, again, the same thing as I said before, we see ticks. They seem to hang out in the same area, waterways, in scrub, and that's where your snakes are. But, of course, as I said, we do see them all over backyards in Newcastle as well, even in Cheryl's backyard.
Yeah. I think part of the problem for me is that I've got, like, lots of bush rocks and gardens. I've got fish ponds, multiple fish ponds, and I've got a bird aviary. So, it was only a matter of
snake
time.
Snake heaven.
Yeah, you've just got a neon light out there for the snakes. Yeah.
She said she doesn't like snakes, and yet she makes it so attractive for them.
Oh, but if anybody does have their dog, don't hesitate to get to the vet is my advice, because it does make a difference. I mean, I could have lost Avalon so easily if we hadn't have got to the vet, because his symptom was just diarrhea.
Yeah, very strange.
Do you notice, like, if a snake bites an animal, can you see where it's bitten it? Or
I have seen a couple. I remember seeing a Jack Russell Terrier, which has got short hair, and it was bitten on the front of the thigh of this dog. So apart from its systemic envenomation, where it was collapsed and vomiting and thing, but that area where it got bitten, the skin and the muscle died off. Mm-hmm. So it ended up with a big deep ulcer in that area. In America, where they have the, rattlesnakes and so on, a lot of their snakes are, they have a local, what we call a cytolytic action, whereas Australian snakes don't tend to do that. So cytolytic just means, lytic means breakdown, and cyto is cell. So it just breaks down the local cells and causes that death in the local tissue, and you get an ulcer develop. So I have actually seen that most of the time in dogs. It's around the face, because they keep going back to bite the snake.
Right.
So they're bitten on the cheek, on the jowl, maybe on the side of the neck, things like that. I've seen them bitten on the ear and lose a part of their ear. And actually just on that, just to tidy up that piece, there are some old wives' tales and old bushy tales about, if your dog gets bitten by a snake, cut its ear and let the blood out. Don't do that. It doesn't do anything because the venom actually moves through the lymphatic tissue.
Not the blood.
No, it actually doesn't enter the bloodstream until the lymph vessels, which transport tissue fluid back to the central circulation, but they don't do that until they get into the chest where the lymphatic duct connects to the vena cava. So there's no point letting the blood out. They need all the blood they can get, right? So, don't do that. Vitamin C does nothing except it acidifies the urine. Some dogs with snake envenomation do have kidney problems and urine problems. So I can see there's, maybe something there, but it does absolutely nothing against snake venom.
Okay, good to know.
Yeah.
I think we've exhausted snakes now.
Exhausted after that.
It's a pet topic.
It is a good pet topic. It is a great pet topic. So in URFM 103.7, this is Pet Chat with Dr. David Tabbert and Cheryl Shaw. And we're going to our Pet of the Week. If you head to our website at 2NURFM.com.au, you'll find Pet of the Week under our lifestyle programs. And we're going to start with Chester, beautiful cat.
Chester? Mm. Have a look at his photo, Amanda. So for anyone who's listening, jump on the website and have a look. That is the most regal pose. And I think it contrasts with the other pet of the week, Winnie, who looks like a bit of a clown. But Chester seems to have the goods. And just reading his notes, he's comes from a stray background, so we're not sure of the full background, but starting to adapt to the home environment pretty well. At the moment, he's actually sharing a house with another cat named Sinatra, which is not Sinatra, but Sinatra.
Sinatra.
I don't know if that's a typo.
It might be a typo.
Or is it a special name?
I don't know. It's a good name.
Yeah, he can purr the girl from Ipanema. I think he needs a house that just needs to settle in slowly. We're not sure about other cats, kids, dogs. Oh, no, he's okay with Sinatra, but maybe that's the singing. Mm. So hopefully we can find a home for Chester.
Yeah, he's beautiful and loves attention and affection. So if you're someone that some people don't like to be touched.
Roll over and scratch my tummy. That's it. Right.
You can check out Chester on our website. Also, we've got Winnie. Winnie's cute.
Winnie looks like one of the dogs I first owned in life growing up as a child. It was called Patch. Didn't have quite as much colour, but very like that dog.
Got a bit of a Dalmatian look about Winnie as well.
Winnie looks like his ears are stuck on like a Halloween costume.
Yeah, he's lovely.
Oh, it's a she.
Winnie. I should correct that.
Yes.
So Winnie is only young though, only 4 months of age, and ready to go to, a home that can provide much affection, but also exercise. We talked about this earlier. So making sure that your pet has the appropriate exercise regime, you've got the time for them, and looking for Winnie to grow up, just remembering that Winnie will require de-sexing in a couple of months, but that's already paid for once you take care of the adoption fee.
Yes, there's all that information on our website if you go to 2NURFM.com.au. And there are some other animals there from previous weeks. They may still be available, not sure, so you can check them out as well. We've got a minute or so. So if you've got want to touch on snakes anymore.
So are snakes cold-blooded or warm-blooded?
Cold-blooded.
Neither.
Why?
Neither.
How can you say that?
They're what's known as poikilothermic.
That's a big word.
So they, it is. That's why I'm using it.
So do they draw the heat into their bodies?
Yes.
Yes.
So they actually take on the environmental temperature, which is why we see them out and about now. But why are they so active? Is because when they consume food, they need that body temperature to be at the right level to be able to digest the food. So during winter, it's too cold, and the food would sit in their gut for too long and start to rot. So they can only consume their food once it starts to warm up. So if you think about it, this is really clever, because if they draw the temperature from outside, then first of all, they don't need to generate their own heat, which means they don't need to consume as much food in the first place.
So they conserve energy as well.
Yes, but it's also a bit of a disadvantage because it means they're limited to warmer environments or warmer seasons, whereas mammals and obviously us humans as mammals generate our own internal core body temperature, which means we can go into cold climates, warm climates, doesn't matter, and that's how we took over the world.
Right. So they hibernate for the winter?
Well, the word hibernate is, yeah, a layperson's term. Otherwise, the word is bruminate.
Bruminate.
Where they basically they're slowing everything down and just conserving energy.
Right.
Yep.
Well, there we go. It's been a fascinating topic on snakes today. We've learned a lot.
Yeah.
Learned a lot. Thank you, David.
No worries.
We'll catch up with you soon. Thank you, Cheryl.
Catch you
on 2NURFM.
Thanks for listening to this podcast from 2NURFM at the University of Newcastle. Topics range from gardening to health, well-being, pet care, and travel. You'll find them all at 2NURFM.com.